Celeb Savant is a career retrospective type interview focusing on singers, actors, and industry experts. Join Barrett Edelstein now as he dives into the entertainment world.
On this episode of Celeb Savant, we will have a tribute to the late Donna Summer with her husband, Bruce Sudano. Bruce Sudano is an American musician and songwriter noted for creating songs for artists such as Michael Jackson, Dolly Parton, Reba McEntire, and his wife, the Grammy Award-winning singer Donna Summer. Bruce is the founder of the indie record label Purple Heart Recording Company. Bruce and Donna were married from 1980 until her passing in 2012. Donna Summer was an American singer and songwriter. She gained prominence during the disco era of the 1970s and became known as the Queen of Disco, while her music gained a global following. Influenced by the counterculture of the 1960s, Donna became the lead singer of a psychedelic rock band named Crow and moved to New York City. In 1968, she joined a German adaptation of the musical Hair in Munich, where she spent several years living, acting, and singing. There she met music producers Giorgio Moroder and Pete Bellotte, and they went on to record influential disco hits together, such as Love to Love You Baby and I Feel Love, marking Donna's breakthrough into international music markets. Donna returned to the United States in 1976, and more hits such as Last Dance, her version of MacArthur Park, Heaven Knows, Hot Stuff, Bad Girls, Dim All the Lights, No More Tears, Enough is Enough with Barbra Streisand, and On the Radio followed. Donna amassed a total of 32 chart singles on the US Billboard Hot 100 in her lifetime, including 14 top 10 singles and 4 number 1 singles. She claimed a top 40 hit every year between 1976 and 1984, and from her first top 10 hit in 1976 to the end of 1982, she had 12 top 10 hits, 10 of which were top 5 hits, more than any other act during that period. She returned to the Hot 100's top 5 in 1983 and claimed her final top 10 hit in 1989 with This Time I Know It's For Real. Donna was the first artist to have 3 consecutive double albums reach the top 10 of the US Billboard 200 chart and charted 4 number 1 singles in the US within a 12-month period. She also charted 2 number 1 singles in the R&B singles chart in the US and a number 1 single in the United Kingdom. Her last Hot 100 hit came in 1999 with I Will Go With You, and she remained a force on the Billboard Dance Club Songs chart throughout her entire career. It is estimated that more than 150 million copies of Donna's albums have been sold worldwide. Donna has won an NAACP Image Award. She has achieved 3 multi-platinum albums in the United States. 11 of her albums went gold in the United States. She has had 12 gold singles. She has won 6 American Music Awards. She was the first female African American to receive an MTV Video Music Awards nomination. Donna has received 5 Grammys in 1978 for Best R&B Vocal Performance Female for Last Dance, in 1979 for Best Rock Vocal Performance Female for Hot Stuff, in 1983 for Best Inspirational Performance for He's a Rebel, in 1984 for Best Inspirational Performance for Forgive Me, and in 1997 for Best Dance Recording for Carry On. Donna also amassed 13 other Grammy Award nominations from 1978 through to 1999. Donna died in 2012 from lung cancer at her home in Naples, Florida. Giorgio Moroder described Donna's work on the song I Feel Love as really the start of electronic music. In 2013, Donna was posthumously inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In 2016, Billboard ranked Donna 6th on its list of the greatest of all-time top dance club artists. Up next on Celeb Savant, paying tribute to the late Donna Summer, is Bruce Sudano. Where in the world are you and how are you doing today?
I'm in Los Angeles and I'm doing well. Thanks.
Lovely.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you, Bruce. Lovely. To see you again. So this is a very special interview podcast because we're going to be doing a tribute to the brilliant late great Miss Donna Summer. So Bruce, how do you fit into the equation? What was your relationship with Donna?
Well, my relationship with Donna began in 1977 in Los Angeles. I was at the house of a friend who was a publicity director at Casablanca Records. Her name was Susan Mineo. And myself and my two partners from Brooklyn Dreams, Jobian Esposito and Eddie Hokanson, were there as well. We were spending a few days there as we were preparing to move to Irvine, California, to record the first Brooklyn Dreams album. And on this particular day, it was a Sunday, Donna was out in her new Mercedes 350 SL convertible, learning how to drive it, because she had spent the previous 8 years living in Germany. Went to Germany when she was 19 to be in the German cast of Hair. And ended up getting married while she was there to Helmut Sommer, and being in Hair and Godspell and The Mean Nobody Knows, and you know, all performing in German, singing all these songs and all this dialogue, speaking in German. She became fluent in speaking German, so anyway, on this particular Sunday when we met, she was just come back from Germany with a hit record, Love to Love You Baby, under her belt, and was out learning how to drive, and decided to take a stop at the publicist for Casablanca, where I was waiting. And so we met.
Lovely. You mentioned this song, Love to Love You Baby, and the other hit, I Feel Love. I remember there was a little bit controversy around I Love to Love You Baby because of the expressions she was using during the song at the time, that it was seemed quite, how do you say, perceived as
over
a person
top.
Over the top. Yes. Which in today's times is a little bit okay. So when there was that controversy and around that, I know you hadn't met her as yet, but maybe you discussed it thereafter. Was she expecting that? And how did she deal with it?
I don't know that she was expecting controversy about it, but maybe she was. I really don't know. You know, I mean, it was an idea that she had. They developed it. Neil Bogart heard the record at Meet'em. You know, it was just a 3 minute and something song. There wasn't a whole lot of heavy breathing going on.
Yeah.
Neil asked them to extend it, Giorgio and Pete and Donna. Donna went back in the studio and added some heavy breathing and performed it quite well, quite convincingly. And anyway, she came here to the States. The song became a hit. It was banned on some stations,
yes.
Things like that. You know, they were playing it at midnight on some other stations, but it became ultimately became a big hit song.
Yeah.
You know, it was a bit of a novelty at the time, because
yeah.
I remember when I was meeting Donna, you know, I was a bit, you know, I had no anticipation of meeting somebody with the amount of ability that she possessed. You know, I mean, I knew that she had this song. It was a bit of a novelty. And you know, I think that, you know, we met and started writing songs almost immediately. You know,
okay.
That was the first day that we met there, right in Susan's house. Joe, Eddie, myself, and Donna, we just became friends and started writing music together.
So you collaborated with her for the duration of her career, correct?
More or less, in one way or another. We
okay.
ended up, we got married in 1980. We were married for 32 plus years until she passed away, you know, and we pretty much formed a partnership that took us from the day of our meeting till you know, the end of her life. And during the course of that time, you know, it was an ever evolving situation of whatever was required in the moment, you know. And that was dad, it was husband, and, you know, she was wife and mother. We had children, we had careers, we had you know, it was very fun, but you know, interesting balancing act that we pulled off. And you know, how do you balance your family life, your parenting, your responsibilities to your mate, and also to your career? You know, we were both pretty driven by our careers. When we met, we were, you know, both in the heat of pursuing our careers. You know, we were late 20s and you know, had worked long and hard to get our careers to the points where we were. And so career was always important to us, but so was family. And so it was an interesting balancing act. And along the way, I was songwriter, I was producer, I was manager, all of those things at different points in time, you know. But basically, we were a partnership, and our lives became one big ball. And we navigated it as best as we could.
One of the titles given to Donna was Queen of Disco, but then that transcended into other genres in the 80s and so forth. With massive hits in the late 70s, Hot Stuff, Bad Girls, Last Dance, MacArthur's Park, and the list is endless. There was also a little bit of backlash towards disco in the late 70s. I remember there was this watching a documentary about the Bee Gees, and they had this whole burning of records or something in Chicago in the late 70s, all the disco records. What were your thoughts around the perception of disco at the time and the backlash for something that was just unifying and enjoyable in the creation of it?
Well, you know, I had a lot of thoughts about it at the time, you know, because, you know, I was somebody who came up on the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, and, you know, and I understood blues and rock and roll and what it means and what it stood for. And I understood some of the critique of disco music in that it, you know, there were some disco records that were very trite, or you know, the song structure, or however you want to look at it. But I also was of the opinion that disco music was also evolving musically. You know, there was some great records made with, you know, some great grooves by some great musicians, and beautiful string arrangements and powerful horn lines, and, you know, great vocals and meaningful songs, you know. And I think that's what was attempted to be created with Bad Girls. You know, like all genres of music, you know, it starts somewhere, and then it grows and moves from there. And you know, I think that Donna was, you know, both proud to be the queen of disco because she deserves that title, but also at times felt, you know, hemmed in by that title because, you know, that's not all that she was. And you know, and the revolt in Chicago was interesting. I remember when it was hard to get disco played on certain radio stations. You know, they you know, and this was a big battle that was being raged in the promotion departments in Casablanca to get this music played on the radio, because even radio was being a bit snobbish about what the imagery was and all of this. So it was an ongoing evolution, and ultimately the war was won. And it's just interesting to me now that, you know, how radio has both shrunk and evolved to a place these days where, you know, dance music is prevalent. It's almost as if the tables have flipped. You know, now I think if you make a rock record, try to get it played on pop radio. I don't know. Not that the impact is the same anymore at radio, but, you know, this was the case in those times.
And disco was definitely the foundation of all the dance music, trance music, all the different music that came through. So absolutely was a huge foundation.
Essentially, Love to Love You Baby was the first extended mix. You know, I mean, there became a whole culture of dance mixes and remixes and extended versions and all of that. You know, but it was really Love to Love You Baby, and that all that evolved from, you know, because it was really the discotheques that broke that record on a whole other level. And it was also the convergence of times where of a time where discotheques were becoming you know, worldwide and you know, ubiquitous form of what were the clubbing that people began to do. You know, when I was coming up and playing in bands, I grew up playing in clubs. Clubs were a place for live music. And it was also that transition that was happening where at some point, you know, my band was the house band at the Electric Circus in New York, which, you know, was a music venue built around psychedelia, if you would, and how it transferred into this thing of the discotheque and the gay clubs and the straight clubs and the black clubs and it all morphing into one big scene.
If I remember correctly, Donna had three songs in the top five on the Billboard charts. I think it was Bad Girls, Hot Stuff, and Dim All the Lights in 1 week or for a couple of weeks. And she was one of the, at that time, and for many years after, one of the handful of only artists to ever achieve that. I think it was Elvis, the Beatles, Donna, and then obviously these days. But I mean, for a good 30, 40 years, she was in a category of just a small minority to achieve that accomplishment. So when creating this music and creating the songs, were you guys, yourself and Donna, surprised by the success and the momentum? Or was it just a build-up of very hard work that you guys had been working on?
You could feel it coming. You know, the energy was there. You know, you could feel the energy at Casablanca. Every, you know, it was a well-oiled machine. Everybody was at the top of their game. Giorgio Pete and Jorgen Kopper's in the studio. Donna, you know, her creativity. You know, when you are in this rhythm of this kind of motion, you know, you just pick up energy, you know, and even though you're working 24 hours a day, probably harder than you've ever worked in your life, it's nonstop coming from all angles for all different reasons. Everybody has their priority, whether it be the photo shoot, the interview, you know, the live performance, the TV show, the recording session. It's all going on at once, but there's an energy that you take on, you kind of get in the rhythm of what's happening, you know, and you just feel, you can just feel this elevation. So yeah, it's a surprise, but it's also, oh, you're building up for it and you're ready for it and you don't even realize it. That's how it felt to me anyway.
Creating music. Obviously, you said you worked a lot with Donna and writing the songs. What were those creation processes like? Obviously, they were always different, but how were the collaborations and the creations of all these music classics? How did they come to be?
Donna worked with Giorgio Moroder and Pete Bellotti for a long time before I came into the picture, you know, and you know, they are both masters, you know, at what they do. There was Jürgen Kopper's, who I always say is the unsung hero there, you know, who's a great engineer, made great sounding records. You know, when the Brooklyn Dreams and I came into Donna's scene, it was at a very crucial time because we were both new to Los Angeles. The Dreams were recording their first album. Donna came and sang a background on our first album. She was back in a new country where she hadn't been for 8 years, and it's in a place, California, with that she's never lived in before. And so we kind of found this bond. You know, we had very similar roots of us growing up in Brooklyn and her growing up in Boston. We had the same taste in music. We had the same influences. So there was a bonding that was formed that was comfortable for all of us. We were like strangers in a strange land, a certain way. And you know, I think in a certain way, the Brooklyn Dreams became a cushion for Donna, a support system for Donna. Take that next step. You know, we went on tour with her, that we were her opening act on that. It was called the Summer Nights Dreams Tour of 1979. And we would come out during her show and do Bad Girls with her and do other little bits and skits in her show. And so We took this ride with her, and Susan Mineo became her manager. And Susan was a girl that grew up in Brooklyn. I knew her since she's 17 years old. I've known her. So it was, we became one little family, and
So when it came through from the 70s with the success of disco and then sort of disco petering out, and then the new dawn of the 80s with the different genres and the different things coming through, was there any challenge for you all, and especially Donna, to, as you mentioned earlier, she didn't want to just be labeled as the disco queen. She wanted to be seen in other genres. But moving out of that era of the 70s and 80s, were there any challenges that were faced that, and how were those challenges faced that and dealt with?
I think that the Bad Girls album was really a breakthrough record, and it on a lot of levels, because it was, of a genre, but it was very diverse. And it's a four-sided record, it's a double album, and there's a thread of a story going through that album, as well as a musical evolution and a change in sides as each side progressed. There are ballads, there are country influences used, but the core of the record is still the production of Pete Giorgio, and the center and the heart and soul of it is Donna. So you don't feel an incongruity there, but you feel a diversity of sound and song and melody and thought process and heart and soul. I think this record set the tone for what happened as it transversed into the 80s. So in the 80s, you had the beginning. I'll tell you an interesting story that happened yesterday. I was at a gathering at a house here in Los Angeles with a bunch of people from the art world. And at some point, a guy came up to me and he said, "I have a Donna Summer story to tell you." And his name was Todd, and I don't remember his last name, but he's a photographic artist. He told me in 1979 at the American Music Awards, he was there with Michael Jackson. At the 1979 American Music Awards, Donna basically swept those awards. And Michael was also nominated for his "Don't Stop Till You Get Enough" album, and Michael was frustrated and was voicing his frustration to this photographer, saying, "Why am I relegated to the R&B category when Donna is nominated in all these diverse categories?" And I thought, "Wow, this is really an interesting thing to learn," he said, because he also took a picture of Donna and Michael that day. And it's a very famous picture that I had no idea that this guy had taken. I didn't know who the photographer was, but it's this, picture that you always see whenever it's a picture of Donna or Michael. It's this picture. He said to me, he said, "You could actually see the discontent in Michael's face in taking this picture, But the point is that goes back to my point about Bad Girls, how it set the tonality for what was to come in the 80s, and Beat It and Thriller and the diversity of those records. But it was Bad Girls, I believe, that set this, I can't think of the word, but you know what I mean. So for Donna, on a creative level, and for Pete and George, I think Giorgio, I think they went into the concept of the next album, which was The Wanderer, with how do we continue to evolve? How do we continue to grow? How do we pull in from what's new that's coming in, and what am I hearing from the UK, and what are we hearing from Europe, and what are we seeing in the punk movement, and all of this new wave thing? How do we incorporate it to what we do? And make our next record and write our next songs. And I think that's what you see with the record, The Wanderer. It's an evolution. It's an incorporation of what new was happening in the moment, and what how they incorporated it to their creativity and made another great album.
And if you look at Donna's repertoire of albums and releases, and some artists, they always try and recapture, you know, that gold instead of moving forward. So, but with her, it was evolving with the times. It was working on new types, new energies, new focuses, and not trying to recapture what was already succeeded in Bad Girls. And you could definitely pick it up. I mean, like, use Wondra, She Works Hard for the Money, Dinner with Gershwin, the Stock Aitken Waterman, Colors, all these brilliant collections of art. It was always about what was happening at the time.
Yeah, what was happening at the time, and where was it leading? Where was it going? And this is the testament of a true artist. This is what artists do. What the business does on the other side of it,
yes. The
other voices that you're hearing are like, hey, we need another one of this.
Yes.
We need, don't move too far this way. Stay over here.
Yeah.
So there's always this, again, I'm lacking the word, but, you know, this conflict that's going
yes.
on and being put upon the artist. And so it's always an interesting conversation, you know, because artists want their work to be heard, seen, experienced.
Mm.
They want to be successful at what they're doing. No artist wants to continue to live in poverty. They want to succeed. So it's not always a conversation that artists of any genre are always comfortable speaking about, you know, because they always want to speak, I'm an artist, and you know, but there is that side of it of where they do want to be heard. They do want to be successful. So you have to listen to those voices at the same time, because in reality, they do have validity and you're aware of that. So it's an interesting tightrope to walk and
navigating that. Now, a lot of people don't know that Donna was also a painter. What did she enjoy about painting?
It's a good segue from what we were just speaking about, because she enjoyed the freedom to create whatever it is that was coming through her without listening to any voices, you know, and she speaks about it herself in the documentary about not having to listen to, you know, a producer, an agent, a manager, a record company representative. She was free to create whatever she was feeling in that way. So that's what she loved about painting. It was a solo environment, and it was a solo expression, free from there were no bass player involved. There was no producer involved. It was just her with some paint and her imagination, which was very active.
At what stage did she start painting? Was she always doing it, or was it something she started at during the 80s or at a later time?
It was a gift that she always had and would always play around with, in that she always would have a pad. She'd always be designing a room or designing an outfit or a costume for stage or you know, putting in an addition on the house. She had a very good gifting for art in that way. And, you know, would do sketches at periods of time. But it was in this particular condensed period of 1988 to 1990 where she almost solely focused on painting and created, I think what we have is somewhere around 300 pieces of art.
Oh, wow.
She always had this gift. She continued to paint somewhat afterwards, but it was a very focused period of time where a good part of her artistic creation was in painting, and it was basically a three-year period.
So, Bruce, I know it's a very difficult question, this one, and I'm going to share mine. I know you love them all, but the top three or four songs of her career that are your favorites, or can't you give that answer?
Well, I mean, they're favorites for different reasons.
Yes.
You know, my favorite song is called There Will Always Be You. It's a song that Donna wrote by herself on the Bad Girls album. And it's only been recently that I've come to the awareness of how much of the songs written on the Bad Girls album reflect the inception of our relationship. But anyway, so that's my favorite song, There Will Always Be You. And then what's another favorite song? You know, I don't know. You know,
too many.
Yeah, there's so many great songs, you know. So I'm trying to go for some more obscure, this fascination on the Quincy record. That's really great. No, that's not on the Quincy record. That's on Harold Faltermeyer produced that. I think that's on All System Go. There's Lush Life on the Quincy record. That's great. Different things.
I think, you know, and
Not.
I think I've got all of Donna's, most, if not all, of her collections in my CD collection. So I love them all. But the ones that come top of mind, which always gets me, and I also try to go a little bit obscure, but not really. So I love Heaven Knows. I love No More Tears, Enough Is Enough. And then Dinner with Gershwin, This Time I Know It's For Real. Stomp the Ground from Crayons. And there's just too many. So those are the five that come through at this time.
I thought you were going to go for a State of Independence.
That is on the
No.
list, but I'll just, you just reminded me of that.
No, yeah, there's it, it's there are a lot of great songs
Yeah.
and it's a lot of great music, and there's still a lot to explore. I mean, the thing that's interesting for me is as I get to share in the joy of continuing to share Donna to the, with the world and her music with the world, and to see how her music continues to resonate. Different songs take on different current meaning in different moments, and it's really interesting to see. It makes me very happy. In some ways, she gets commands a whole lot of respect now, where maybe when she was alive, she didn't actually fully feel. So it's very, very gratifying for me and our family, and look to expose the catalog and Donna and who she was and her great talent to future generations.
Bruce, the podcast is listened to throughout the world. So, as a final message, channeling Donna, who's with us in this moment, what would you like to say?
I'd like to say, be kind to each other. We're all trying to get through this life. Look at the things that you have to be grateful for them. Try not to buy into all the anger and the hate, and be a light wherever you go.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Celeb Savant. Please follow Barrett on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook at Celeb Savant. That's CelebSavant.